Paul, Sarah, Ben, what year did you learn that emotion is not conveyed well through text, and therefore you have to assume the best of people on the other side of a text conversation and not escalate when you're having an online text, argument of some sort?
Joel, I learned that on Thursday, December 17th, 2020, and I'll learn it again on December 18th, and then I'll learn it again.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Stack Overflow podcast. Today is a very special day. We're celebrating episode 300, and we've brought on, a special guest, none other than Joel Spolsky, who recorded the first ever Stack Overflow podcast on which they discussed creating a company called Stack Overflow, right? I think that's how I remember it.
I don't remember the earliest episodes.
I went back and listened when I was starting.
Yeah, I don't remember when we revealed Stack Overflow, but it was a bit in. It's all.
Listening to episode one, you're sort of on there discussing, you're saying, this is a company, we're not quite ready to talk about it publicly fully, but here's some ideas.
Yeah.
And then you discussed how Windows would never be replaced, desktop Windows would never be replaced by smartphones.
Huh, we did?
It was 2008, that's not fully.
Baloney. I don't believe that.
History's still going to prove you right. It's we just need a minute.
We just need the pendulum to swing back to Windows,
Windows 11. Windows 11 is going to prove us all wrong.
Yeah. The only thing I remember about the original podcast is we had a couple of things. One is it was the cold intro. The idea was that this was a found artifact of a recording from our telephone system that somebody had found and put up on the internet.
Oh, wow. You didn't know you were being recorded.
No, I mean, that was supposed to be the idea. Yeah, yeah. It was, I mean, Jeff and I were like, here's what we'll do. We have to have our weekly meeting anyway. Let's just record it. And then let's just cut out the part at the beginning, at the end, where we talk about anything that we don't want people to hear. And then the middle part, just whatever is left. And I think the first episodes really sounded like a phone audio system because they went over the phone. Like we had Skype hadn't yet been invented.
Wild. You were on smartphones though. Right. Yeah.
What? No. We were on the how they used to have office phone systems
that
plugged into the internet instead of plugging into a POTS line. And then there was an open source Asterix or something. Yeah. And so we ran that at Fog Creek and but then we wrote some code probably in, that's a good programming language.
When Linux isn't bad enough.
Yeah. We had to write some code to record the conversations. And I think what we did is the code listened for a certain doop doop, kind of audio beeping, and then would just start a recording when you press that on the phone. And then we would go find the WAV files and try to make a podcast out of them.
We all used to have those in our office. I think when I first started to work at Stack Overflow, I had one of those phones and sometimes it rang.
Yeah.
And I was like, what is happening? I don't know.
What could this be?
This device is making noise. I don't know
what to do. Is this a fire drill? Get out of the building now.
I was born too late for this. Yeah. I can't. What? No way.
You don't remember phones in offices? Yeah.
No, I do. I'm making fun of Sarah. No, you'd have the landline. I'm for people who are listening, Asterix is like a deep cut from the early days of open source. That was a big deal that you could do open source telephony.
Right. It could run your whole office phone system.
Because those systems were tens of thousands of dollars. It was a total scam. But it's called Asterix because, you'd hit that little button on your phone, that Asterix button, and then you could do things. And And of course the company would be like, hey, let's just do everything with our touchtone phones. Let's start were they even called podcasts when you started?
Yeah, podcasts were invented long before.
Well, sure. That's an RSS enclosure.
Yeah, I need to clear up the record. It was definitely invented by Adam Curry.
That's right.
With Dave Weiner's help. I don't know if that's what Wikipedia says, but that is absolutely no question. Is that Adam Curry said to Dave Weiner, I'm going to record things and I'm going to drop them in a place that you can listen to. And Dave helped him get it set up so he could drop it in a place with RSS. And that just became podcasting. And any other story about the origin of podcasting is completely false.
Yeah.
No, that's true. I remember that. That was a big deal.
2004, originally called audio blogging.
They called it podcasting for a while. And then Apple made the podcast thing and tried to tell people they couldn't call them podcasts. And some people thought that they would have to call them netcasts because Apple was trying to trademark podcasts, but that never went anywhere. So we're back to podcasts now. And
so you guys recorded your meetings, published them. And then when did you change to the, what made you change the more podcast format?
I don't think I did. I think probably some marketing people at Stack Overflow were like, come on, we got to do this seriously.
Well, also, I remember going into the office, you'd built a very nice podcast studio by the end. That's like a good nerd motivation on the other side, right? Like, it's like, well, sure. Now we have to have a beautiful studio. Talk a little bit there, Joel. Like, you were building in public, right? Which I think is even still an unusual thing, even though I think more people talk about it. How did that work? Like, you're going out into the world, you're two people, you and Jeff are talking, and then people are giving you feedback and you're building software. Like, how did that all play out?
I think that the original motivation was just to get people to use Stack Overflow when it launched. And we sort of knew if you just launch a thing that needs people and nobody has ever heard of it, then, you know, what are you supposed to do? You could tweet about it or something, and then 16 mm-hmm. people go check it out. Like, that was not, you really have to, just as much as you have to have a strategy for building all the code, you have to have a strategy for developing the audience that you're going to need, because that, in a network like Stack Overflow that depends on people, is even more important, I think, than the code. And so once Jeff and I had figured out the basic parameters, we said, all right, where do we bring in the people? And we had the rough idea, which is the Joel on Software, you know, viewers or readers. And Jeff had another blog as well called Coding Horror. So mm-hmm. we could bring in some of our regular blog readers onto Stack Overflow. But we didn't know if that would be enough or if that would be really, we just knew that there had to be some other thing to build up this audience of people. And we also knew that we had the, what do they call it? The empty restaurant syndrome or whatever, which is, if you want to open a restaurant, you got to have all your friends come the first week, because if anybody walks by and sees a newly opened restaurant and they look in the window and there's nobody in there, then they think there must be something wrong with that restaurant. So you got to have a lot of people at the very beginning. And for Stack Overflow, obviously people have to be getting answers to their questions.
You were also really solving a market problem. Like, I mean, there was the state of online advice was a disaster.
Yeah, no question we had a better mousetrap, but if we hadn't gotten the people in, it never would have.
Yeah, that's true.
Take it all. You can make great mousetraps all you want. It just, somebody has to come participate in your mousetrap. So that was the idea of the podcast. I'm like, we got to do a podcast because we got to get some of these people lined up and like twitching to get started on day one. And that was sort of the idea. So we said, why don't we just record the making of, and people will follow along.
And were you in there at the beginning asking and answering, like, to try to solve that ghost town problem? Were you seeding stuff into the network?
No, we didn't really have to. I mean, the original idea was that we wanted people to show up in the first minute and see something already there. And I had been running this little discussion group on Joel on Software, which old timers will remember as .NET questions, where it was a place where you could ask questions about .NET and get answers. And we sort of thought, hey, let's take that. That will sort of seed the content for Stack Overflow. And in fact, that was in the database for a while we were developing Stack Overflow, just to give us some kind of raw data that we could kind of manipulate with. But that was in discussion format. It wasn't in Q&A format. And that means that some of the answers were not answers. So it was kind of the wrong structure of data to actually have on Stack Overflow. And we sort of thought it would just be the seed so that people saw something the first day they got there. And at the last minute, we decided, this is garbage. I don't want anybody to see this non-Q&A format where some of the answers are comments, basically, or non-answers, essentially. And also, there was no voting going on .NET questions. So at the last minute, we decided just to delete all those questions, which is why the early Stack Overflow questions do not have the number one, are not question number one, because of the way identities work in SQL Server. I won't go into that, but for people who know about that.
One day you'll be able to auction that off, you know, that you can retrofit and somebody can get that first question.
Is that even possible in SQL Server? I know it's been a few years, they might have added features, but there was a time
we're
where
managers,
to get
don't
an
ask
identity.
Us. Yeah,
yeah, that's just, I mean, I just ported it all to Postgres. So it would be fine.
Oh, okay.
Sarah, do you remember how you sort of found out about it? And Joanne, you were in the first 5,000. You were in the 4,000s, right, as a user?
Yeah, I think I was a friend of the family. I had some friends that were working on Stack Overflow, and they're really excited about it. They're talking about what they were building. And I knew Jeff and, of course, heard of Joel. And so they were like, there's going to be this new thing and you can ask questions. And I was like, oh, that sounds great. That sounds really valuable. I always tell people it was like, it used to be online that it was like recipes, right? You know, like right now, if I want a recipe for cherry pie, I like Google cherry pie and then I have to read like someone's story about their mom and how their mom loved cherry pie and like where they go to get their cherries and like what their strategy is about apple pie or cherry pie. And then I get to read their recipe like three pages later. That was basically the internet, the coding internet before Stack Overflow. And so it was really beneficial. I just saw it like explode. It was so cool.
When did this thing tip? Like was it a month? Was it a year? Was it 2 years where you're like, oh, there it goes. Wow.
Yeah, no, it tipped instantly. Yeah, I mean, it tipped in minutes. I as soon as Jeff told me that I could log on and check it out, I planned to log on and ask the most recent programming problem I had, which was something about like using a regular expression to find a URL when the URL might be at the end of a sentence, and so the URL has a period after it. So that was my question that I was going to ask. And actually, I literally started typing the question, and by the time I typed the title, Stack Overflow had identified somebody had already asked that question.
Wow, cool.
So I'm like, okay, I guess I don't have to ask the question. I looked at it and it already had, I'm going to guess, four answers already that people had submitted. And there had been a lot of voting. And the number one question had already received, the best answer had actually received the most votes and had already come to the top. So I don't know, it was probably on the first day or two. Like it did take me a minute because I was out of internet range the minute it launched. But yeah, it tipped right away. Pretty much everybody was getting answers kind of instantaneously. And it went from, we had Google Analytics set up all the way from the beginning. And I think the first day was 30,000 unique users or something. And then the next day was like 90,000. And then it just sort of went up very, very quickly.
Did you have a sense at that moment where you're like, well, that's the next few years of my life?
I mean, the sense that I had was that we would definitely change the way all programmers worked, which was a weird kind of grandiose sense. But I was really thinking about how, you know, a programmer has an editor and they have a compiler, and now they're going to have Stack Overflow, you know, like every programmer. There are programmers that don't have, I don't know, continuous integration. But there are no programmers that don't have editors, and there are no programmers that don't have compilers, and there are no programmers that don't use libraries, and no programmers that don't, you know, use a keyboard. And there's a lot of stuff out there that there are programmers that don't use. There are programmers without frameworks, and there are programmers without, you know, drag and drop GUI coding and stuff. But it suddenly occurred to me there's not going to be any programmers without Stack Overflow. Mm-hmm. I didn't know about COBOL programmers, but everybody else.
One thing I think is really
neat in there too.
Is that Stack Overflow gets a lot more traffic than all the coders in the world, right? Like there's 23 million coders in the world, and we see a lot more than that on the site. So it's very cool. It doesn't have to be just professional developers. It's a lot of hobbyists and professional developers with like four machines.
Yeah. So, you know, let's just count. I don't know how we really count programmers. There's a lot of non-professional programmers that do programming. And nonetheless, and that's sort of what's important, you know, whether it's makers or honestly, just people that for their professional reasons need to do some coding, but it's not even close to what they're supposed to be doing at their job.
No, but you think about Excel you could make the argument that every buddy who creates an Airtable database as a programmer. Like it's just, once you get...
No, I don't even need to do that. There's a lot of people whose job is like, nuclear physicist or whatever, and they're just in Python all day long, you know?
Oh, yeah. Oh, or they write the worst Fortran imaginable, right? But no, yeah. I mean, they need a place to hack it out as well, right? Like that was always the tags kind of helped segment out that. Were the tags there from the beginning?
Yeah, that was an important part of it. That was to avoid the whole like, oh, let's make a big hierarchy like in Usenet. And then in Usenet, when you made a hierarchy, you got cross-posting, and cross-posting was bad.
Boy, was it. It was so bad.
Yeah, because you would see the same thing twice. Like, yeah, like I'm interested in C and I'm interested in Windows. It doesn't mean I want to see somebody's Windows programming question in C twice. I don't need to. That's bad. But they would try to post it in both places to get the most answers. So anyway, let's stop talking about the past. I'm gonna derail this whole conversation now.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the future a little bit.
Go for it.
Okay, so what do you guys think is going to happen by 2025? I think this is the year of...
Fascinating.
Here's what I'm interested in, just like intellectually, and it's not really what I'm working on. What I'm working on is like two things, which many of you will find very boring. One of them is getting individually addressable LED lights to light up in pretty patterns. And this is sort of, it's a solved problem. It's not that interesting, but it's fun to me. But let's go to the future. I think that the lesson of Stack Overflow, I have to pick one lesson of Stack Overflow. Like if there's really only one thing that people should learn from Stack Overflow, it would be that you have to build the software in a way that kind of forces people to behave in a way that has the right social outcomes. And however you build the software, whatever features you put in there, they're going to use it for their own purposes. And what their purposes are is probably driven by economics, honestly, because, you know, commerce is going to drive out everything else. So what I'm thinking about is, like, what are the biggest problem areas right now in online social networking, let's call it? And there's kind of a bunch of problem areas, and I'm trying to figure out ways that you could build architectures that made it impossible to ever have those problems again.
I think the way you build that architecture, it like also has to do with the humans building the architecture. Because one thing right now, where I'm writing this whole D&I module for our moderators right now, and the more I read, the more it's been fascinating to me just talking about different, I just learning about different cultures and their customs and things like that. And I just think about, like, if I was building something for the entire world, how would I do that? How would I think about all these things? So thinking about those use cases, yeah. I think, like, all the different people that are using your platform building it, I think that's really helpful. As far as the architecture, I think that's a really tough problem. And I don't think anyone's solved that yet. There's a bunch of people working on it right now.
I'm going to float an idea here. It's going to take me a minute or two. And again, like, this is not an idea that is very well developed. I don't want to say, like, oh, I made a product based on this. Everybody should check this out. I just want to sort of float it, because maybe somebody will hear it and they'll riff on it and they'll make a product and they'll solve the world's problems. I'm going to list a couple of hypotheses, and then I'm going to actually, like, propose an example of an architecture that I think would be kind of a way to deal with this. So my first hypothesis is that capitalism, while wonderful and so forth, capitalism will crowd out non-capitalism. So markets crowd out regular human interaction. And by crowding out, I just mean, like, the minute you let it in, it will sort of push out the natural human interaction.
And it's fairly anti-human. Like, it's not like it's not good for humans, but it doesn't optimize for humans.
No, people optimize the market, not the sort of not social aspects.
I mean, I'll give you, and I have a bunch of examples of, you know, capitalism crowding out, but the most common one is, hey, Stack Overflow is a gift economy where you answer a question as a gift. And if you asked any of the people, like John Skeet, if you said, John, you are really smart, I need you to help me with a C++ programming problem, I will pay you $250 to help me for 10 minutes. He would just say no. And he would say no because he doesn't have time. And I guess with John Skeet, I think if you probably got it up to about $5,000 and a donation to something that he loved, I think he might help you with your problem. But he will do for free what he will not do for hundreds of dollars. And that is true of literally, I don't know, 500,000 people on Stack Overflow every month that are in that exact position. So one thing Jeff Atwin and I always spoke about very clearly is there cannot possibly be any money involved on Stack Overflow. This can't just turn into a thing where you pay $5 and you get faster service or something, because we knew that would crowd out the volunteer and the gift aspect of Stack Overflow. So that's example number one. But let's go with example number two. This is my favorite one, is blogging. There was a golden time, Paul, when we could write blogs. You could write blogs, and Google would be like, whoa, blogs, this is authentic, real content written by actual people who have actually evaluated things, and they shall be prioritized. And just linking to something from a real blog, which was all the blogs were real blogs, would give it power in Google. What made that go away is basically, let's call it the HubSpots of the world, which is all of a sudden a bunch of teenagers were hired to write 3 blog posts a day in order to generate 300 blog posts a day for, like, Coleman's Mustard. Because what happened is, as soon as there was an economic incentive, there was sort of commerce got in there, it crowded out. And today, I never see blogs in search results for even the most specific things. There's definitely been this crowding out of, like, the real and the genuine and the free and the volunteer. It's gotten crowded out by commerce. And I'm going to take a third example, which is a fun one, which is about Burning Man, where you're not allowed to sell things. And it's in some ways like a music festival where you might be walking around and people are selling t-shirts and whatnot. But people are not permitted to sell things. And sort of a magical thing happens at Burning Man, which is that when somebody approaches you to try to talk to you, they are not trying to sell you anything or get your signature on anything or steal from you in any way. They're actually just there to talk to you, to actually have a real human conversation. And the end result is that there's this weird feeling of walking around for a week in a place where everybody's friendly. You're just like at a family reunion almost. There's no, if somebody comes up to you and starts speaking, you don't immediately try to shut them down and get away as you do in Times Square. And so the very fact that commerce has been prohibited creates a zone where the regular human thing of somebody comes up to talk to me and I talk to them, and then we have a regular human conversation that isn't caused by one person trying to get something out of somebody else. The sort of magical zone is thereby created. There's my three simple examples of the commerce. Now, what makes commerce possible? And I don't think there's anything wrong with commerce or capitalism. I'm not trying to, this is supposed to be a screed of like, therefore we must go back to central planning. To me, capitalism is not like an ism, like, oh, I believe in capitalism. It's more like just a description of how the economics works. It's just kind of, that's how economics happens. You know, you can try to avoid it if you want, but the question is like, how do you kind of recreate those zones? And those zones are like the family picnic, right? The extended family, we all get together for a picnic. There is no buying and selling at the family picnic. You know, just because uncle whatever brought the pina coladas doesn't mean that he's now allowed to sell them to the members of his family.
What about reputation? I mean, reputation and social capital are some of the things that definitely motivate people on Stack Overflow, right? Like not necessarily the commerce of it, but being known in the community and being able to say like, you know, I help X many people. That's one of those things that.
That's nice. I think there's definitely some of that there. And Stack Overflow has maintained itself successfully, as has actually Wikipedia, I would say, have both somehow managed to maintain themselves as decommodified zones where there hasn't been. And I think on Stack Overflow, we lucked out because there's almost no economic incentive. There's almost not enough things that you might want to sell in Stack Overflow. But the real thing about Stack Overflow that really makes this work is that there's no single page that gets enough page views that somebody would want to hack that page. Mm-hmm. You would kind of have to hack all conversation. Like it's too hard. So now when I think about that with social networks, I realized that the easiest thing you could hack about social networks that would make quote unquote commerce impossible or spammers or even trolls is popularity. And so what would be the algorithm for a social network where it was impossible to become popular? Right? It's weird, but just imagine that. So imagine, for example, it's just like one possible outcome. The outcome is like, I cannot friend somebody on my new social network that I just created unless we bump phones. It could be bump, or it could be like the thing that Apple does. I don't know what it's called, where there's like a little star field and then the one camera scans the other star field and they do a key exchange essentially. So it's a key exchange. And then the software is designed in such a way that the key exchange must be done in person when you're physically with a person. And then there could be some other limitation. So you can't just, you know, if you're a superstar celebrity, you can't just have your assistant stand outside of the gates of the concert hall and just sign everybody up. But actually, you can really only use this to actually, this is actual friends you actually know. And maybe.
So I have three contacts on the social network.
Exactly. This is a post-pandemic social network. It's got to be like, we got to go actually see each other. So what that means is that there's no way to get a lot of followers. It just becomes impossible to get a lot of followers. And because there's not a lot of followers, there's no reason for brands to participate in this social network. And there's no reason for anybody to try to sell anything, honestly, because they're just not going to sell enough of it. And so all of that selling behavior is now impossible and goes away. And that includes political selling, by the way, which means by political selling, I mean just ranting and raving about your stupid politics, your incredibly smart politics, or your incredibly whatever, but, you know, virtue signaling or whatever you want to call it, all that kind of stuff. This isn't a good place to do that. You're going to have to go do that somewhere else because your maximum size of your audience, you know, is in the tens or, you know, maybe 100, but they're all your close friends. There's no forwarding. There's no following, there's no celebrities. So I'm throwing that out as just an idea for people to think about, which is, you know, there are ways with software that we could create new rules. And those rules, you know, they would have a bunch of positive and negative side effects, but they can be used to create the kind of social network we might want.
All right, let me throw that back at you though, because it's like, why even conceive of that? It feels like the form of the social network has gotten wedged in everybody's brain, but it's like, I'd rather just have a group chat, right? Like, I mean, all that work and all that labor, why centralize anything? To me, I'm just increasingly like, let's just give up and let the cloud providers offer, you know, like build little easy Slack-alikes or DM-alikes where you can set up a little community with your friends.
Yeah.
The thing I miss the most is light piracy. Like, hey, check out this thing. You know, as opposed to just endless embeds in a stream, like just like a little community knowledge base, the shared Dropbox folder, something like that. It feels like an app like that would just get huge lock-ins with clusters of people. And it doesn't even need a hub. It doesn't need a central place.
Yeah. I mean, the lesson of the pandemic for me has been that I get a lot more value out of those actually personal text chains that I'm on with friends and family than I do out of doom scrolling my way through the social networks. And I listened to that tech ethicist, Tristan Harris, talking about the social dilemma. And I think what he was saying that kind of relates back to what Joel is, we sort of need a wake-up call, kind of like there was an ecological movement to say, like, it's clear this isn't healthy for us. What are some things we could do to, like, motivate people to act in a different way or gravitate towards, you know, these alternatives.
My head's been running the scenario, like, what do the next 5 years look like, you know, to Joel's prompt, right? So a big social comes under increasing regulatory pressure and kind of like, who the hell knows what happens, but I think it just gets a little more boring, probably in a good way. But yeah, I just sort of feel like lots of little decentralized apps is where, because it always just sort of swings the other way. You know, your friend will set up your room and then you'll go hang out there.
What I mean, the internet has always been the story of the internet, going back to like the first story that was written about it in USA Today in 1989 or whatever it was you can have a friend in Pakistan who is also interested in making LED chaser circuits using, you know, 555 ICs. And you're like, oh, yeah, that's really cool, because I certainly am not going to find one of those in my community. And so the idea that you would find these people that shared interests all over the world and then you could then communicate them, that was definitely what everybody has been working on now for 30 years.
Yeah,
that's right.
And that is the solved problem, right? And the trouble is that that problem leads to, it's got its problems in some places. A lot of times there are very disruptive people on the groups and it's hard to get rid of them, maybe because they have the knowledge, maybe because you don't, the group is not really set up to censor itself, but there's all kinds of ways that individuals can kind of screw up one of those groups if you just sort of let them in. And the other thing is, honestly, like a lot of the, there's definitely been a lot of bad things that have happened on the internet because we have allowed people to find each other.
Yeah. Right? Like, should we be letting them? Yeah. I think about this a lot when I'm doom scrolling. It's like, is man supposed to have a place where they can yell into a void and millions of people can see it? Like, is that supposed to exist?
Human discovery is such a chore too now, right? Like, it's all just, it used to be very joyful. That is a thing that is sort of gone out of it. It's like, you'd find that person in Pakistan and you'd be, it would change like five or six things about the way you saw the world. You'd be like, my God. And then you'd find out after a while that they had some fundamental difference in their belief system than you did. And that would force you to reevaluate all kinds of stuff. And so it was an actual rich kind of human interaction. And we're back to the market. The market forces are utterly against that. They amplify whatever the strongest opinion is. And they kind of just like, you know, you're just blown back from your phone as you read. And you're like, oh, I thought that person was really good at metadata, but it actually, you know, it turns out that they are like really into serial killers. I kind of don't want that in my life right now.
Yeah. When I think about what flipped there, it's, Paul, I think the people we were discovering originally, we were finding them through their blogs and their GeoCities pages, where they were presenting themselves as a human being. And later you discovered you shared an interest. When you now find somebody through a Facebook group, you know, on some narrow topic or a Discourse or a Slack or something, you kind of just see their name. You don't know that much about them. And in fact, when I'm reading the comments, whatever that means, it's just anonymous. It's completely anonymous. You see no faces. You see, I mean, you might see a tiny avatar of a face, but that's usually fake anyway. And you see a bunch of names that are meaningless to you, and you know absolutely nothing about who these people are that are just ranting and talking and talking and talking. So that's a weird kind of wrong thing. And that,
it sounds like we're talking about bringing back forums. Like, it sounds like we should all have our own personal website with a forum on it. And no one's popular on a forum.
A little bit. I mean, there were definitely, it took a long time in forums to actually get to know the key people. And the trouble is that the anonymous people had just as much voice as the key people. So one thing that was nice about their very, very early Instagram is that it was just hooked up to your camera and it didn't actually have the ability. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think it had the ability to take a photo you had already taken and post it, like just because you had it in your camera.
Yeah, it was purely like in the moment. Mm. Yeah.
Who pays for the servers? Are we all sending our $3 a month? Because if there's no
money, I think so. My theory is it doesn't cost anything to host this. The software is open source, and the hosting is just, it's static pages on the internet that are, you know, encrypted with and there's a public key architecture so that only people that you have met in person and exchanged keys with can read your things. But other than that, it's a little bit of static hosting, and you either host it yourself or you just like point to, I don't know, Cloudflare or somebody that's willing to host static assets for.
It can be like anything. It's the free tier for you and up to 10 friends. And then if you want to build your community, like let's say you're running a conference or it's academic, and that you could have that tier.
This sounds a lot like Mighty Bell. Have you been on Mighty Bell?
No.
Gina Bianchini has a company called Mighty Bell. Mighty Networks, it's called now. Kind of hits all the points you're talking about.
Yes. That was sort of the follow-up of Ning, right?
Yeah.
Because the way it worked with blogs, you know, RSS aside, not a lot of people had RSS readers. Most people had bookmarks, and they had 9 bookmarks that they visited every day of like, I'm going to go to Scripting News, and I'm going to go to John Software, and I'm going to go to Kotke, and I'm going to go to Ben and Mina Trot, and I'm going to go through that. It's like, I'm trying to remember who I had in my list, but I just went to see if they wrote any, something every day. So the idea that they're, you can't have a system where each group needs to be a destination, or you'll only get the people that are very, very dedicated to that group.
Back to the Instagram point, that incentivized incredibly easy creation, right? Like, there is an element of that. Like, I wouldn't mind a daily check-in with my family or my friends where they just send me one picture and everybody puts about 30 seconds of effort into that.
So yeah, that's what that's where I think the delightful thing can happen, where you actually are not permitted to have sort of anonymous followers. There's no follow. That stuff sort of kind of can be crowded out through two things. One is like, it has to be a photograph that you take with your camera. It can't be like a cut and paste, or it can't be somebody else's meme that you're like, everybody put this meme up now. You know, and secondly, it's just, oh, your audience is so small. It's just your friends and family.
See, the foundational challenge here is that, so I think group chats will always keep going, right? But like, the motivation's very tricky. And I think developers in particular, like, there's a sense that people are creative, but so many humans, the other 5-6 billion, feel much more passive. And if how do you get them motivated to actually make and do when they're literally every other signal is just sit here and watch and give it a thumbs up and occasionally drop, you know, that's the big challenge, because otherwise you can't get that velocity.
Yeah, like there may be a situation where the world just consists of 10% sort of producers of content and 90% passive spectators.
Well, I mean, Stack is a great example. That can be really, really productive. It's incredibly productive, but I'm sure, you know, the audience to contributor ratio at Stack is like that, like a tiny percentage write and post, and the rest are there to read.
I sort of wonder, but if those people are, you know, if grandma has essentially her immediate family and that nice old lady down the street and her 7 friends, will she take a picture of her pie that she just took? Sure. Like, it doesn't have to compete with, there isn't a sense of like, oh, I'm competing against all this celebrity content with my picture of a pie.
I mean, even on the text chains, that's the thing. Like, it is nice. People send heartfelt stuff. We have real conversations. But if the person who sends the funny meme gets the most likes on, you know, the little text chain in Apple's closed off
universe. Humans are humans. We're always going to be looking to expand our territory and influence. And they'll, you know, that is just how it goes. Like, who's got the funny, you'll be driving in a car and the person who says the funniest thing kind of wins the car ride. Like, it is.
Yeah.
There's an element of that just in who we are, right? So you can't, the thing is like, when it gets gamified and when you just have this endless, like, what's happened is the worst thing always wins. And boy, is that tiring, because I just don't even look at Facebook anymore. I'm still on Twitter because it just makes me feel like garbage, but it's my garbage.
There's like an entropy to those groups too, right? Like, I've signed up for this random Facebook, I bought like these fake lashes once that I never used, but like there was instructions in the Facebook group. So I like joined, and now like, there are constant political wars in the Lash Facebook group and the fake glasses Facebook group of people freaking out constantly.
That's the thing I'm most disappointed about, humans. I kind of thought by now the whole planet would understand that that person on Twitter is trolling you. Don't feed the trolls.
Yeah, no, it's really tough. I think because you just get one day you have that day where, like, you know, you have trolls coming at you all the time. And then one day they say something that is just like, oh, well, you're so wrong. I'm about to tell you. And then that's your next 3 hours.
It's human nature to at least stand up for yourself and what you believe in.
There's something that's really, really fun to do if you want to is, and it's sometimes tricky to do, but try to find websites that people made for their groups and organizations. They're older. They're usually from a while ago. Like, there's a couple of Squarespace and WordPresses, but mostly, you know, old technology. So when you find this thing, like somebody's got a baseball league or whatever, and you found their website, a lot of times it's like optimized so that it fits in 640 by 480. It's got like, it's just really, really old technology, and it's barely even displaying anymore. But just like every word there is like somebody's kind of heartfelt, like, oh, I'm getting to know them.
Let's each say maybe one or two things we're excited about in 2021 that could be related to technology or science or whatever it may be. What do you think?
I'm going to get a vaccine, big old vaccine.
Yeah.
And then my life will be back to normal.
I'm excited for hugs. Not really. I don't even really like hugs, but I miss them.
Yeah, I don't think of you as like
I don't
hugger,
really. But you know, somehow I miss them.
And I don't even like bars, but I'm going to go to so many bars.
Yeah.
I don't like travel, but I'm going everywhere. I don't like clubs, but I'm going to be in the clubs.
That is true. I just miss like in-person small conversations where you were figuring things out, whether it was like a drink or whether it was. So vaccines are right. What
I'm going to go to a crowded concert and bump into strangers. Maybe I'll ride the subway during rush hour just for the hell of it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, like God. Sometimes when you go to a bar and the bar is so crowded that you literally just have to frottage up 23 strangers to get a drink. And it's like, you know what? Like, that's what we're all here for. So
let's do it.
There's this guy on TikTok who's like, we found who's like a 17-year-old New Jersey DJ. And like wherever he's playing, I'm going. That's what I'm excited about. Just like whatever. Right. He's so hyped. He's throwing napkins. I'm really hyped.
Jersey Shore all the way. Right. Well, yeah, I'm actually, the other thing I was going to say was I'm interested to see what comes out of all the science that went into the vaccine. Cause it was kind of like this space race moment where like the whole world poured so much energy into something. And this new technique, which had actually been sort of like derided for decades, this RNA technique came to the rescue. So I'm interested to see maybe the knock-on effects for other things there could be pretty interesting.
Hey, congratulations to mRNA-based technologies, which I don't understand at all. Good job.
All right, fantastic. And Joe, you said you didn't want to shout out Hash. You don't want to talk about it at all. You're not interested in giving people...
Everybody should check out. I mean, if they're curious about what cool things are going on in the world, everybody should check out hash.ai. That's the URL. .ai is a TLD now, hash.ai, which is a way to build a simulation. It's all through your browser. It's very easy. I mean, it takes some programming to build a simulation, but you may not really know how to do, like if you don't know how to study epidemics, but you're still trying to figure out what's happening during the COVID crisis, and you certainly know how your agents behave, you can build that stuff by building little simple models in JavaScript. And Hash just sort of combines them all, takes a simulation, runs it through a blender and shows you what the outcome will be.
Finally figure out how that zombie invasion is going to go.
All right, great. Well, thanks everybody for coming on episode 300. It's been a blast. I can't believe we made it all the way here. I'm Ben Popper, director of content here at Stack Overflow. You can find me on Twitter at Ben Popper and shoot us an email, podcast@stackoverflow.com.
And I'm Sarah Chips, director of community here at Stack Overflow. And you can find me at Sarah Jo on GitHub.
I'm Paul Ford, friend of Stack Overflow. Check out my company, Postlight.
Joel, you want to sign off and let people know who you are and where they can find you if you want to be found?
Oh, hi, I'm Joel. I'm founder of this podcast. You can find me in real life only. You have to find me as a flesh human being walking around.
All right. And bump phones.